and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bokelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 640.
Man, we're ahead of Green Lantern because they're only at 600.
Pussies.
Got to get those numbers up.
Trust Come me, on, I'm, DC. Sure, I'm sure the numbers are already up to get to 600.
Come on, DC. You've had 80 years. We've had 18. Are we better at this than you?
Well, that's a whole nother debate for another day, I suppose, or maybe not another day.
That's right. So we are talking Green Lantern 600, Green Lantern 33. It's all the same thing. This is the oversized issue. There's a lot to talk about tonight, so we're just going to dive right in. I am going to get creative teams for all four stories out of the way just because I happen to be on that page right now. We have the main story talking about, Kyle and everything, done by Jeremy Adams as a writer. Zermanico does a bit of the art. V. Ken Marion does some more. We also have colorist Romulo Fajardo Jr. on Zermanico, Veronica Gandini on Ken Marion, and letterer Dave Sharp. We also have a origin of Hal Jordan that we're going to get. That is also writer Jeremy Adams, penciler Dan Jurgens, inker Norm Ratmond, colorist Ariana Lucas. Dave Sharp is our letterer throughout all four of these, by the way. And then we have a short story at the end called Light and Darkness with Ron Mars, Daryl Banks, and colorist Chris Sotomayor. So we are going to just get right into the damn thing. We pick up quite literally exactly where we left off, with Hal just disappearing off the face of the moon. And Kyle is left standing behind trying to figure out what's next for him. A week later, we see them on the 405, Kyle along with Odyssey in a car complaining about LA traffic. Jessica calls to check in because he is there to be looking into the escaped prisoners from the science cell, and that seven of them are believed to be back on Earth. So it's his role to be finding said escaped science cell prisoners. Him and Odyssey are doing a little bit of talking, a little bit of bonding. So, she's asking him kind of how we got here, which leads us to a retelling of Kyle Rayner's origin from youth to the point where he gets his ring. Essentially, he's a kid constantly drawing, not really paying attention, couldn't really see how math or anything else had anything to do with his life, and he would dream that he would, have someone to love that gets him someday. And he finds that in Alex, but he gets approached by somebody to draw comics. So he gets so sucked into his dream and his career that he neglects Alex, goes off to find her one night and win her back. And she just says it would take something big to change her mind. He walks out of the club onto the alley and is met by Ganthet, who gives him the ring, as we all know the story goes. And then Kyle wraps up everything just basically saying, and then I was the torchbearer and I helped rebuild the core and blah, blah, blah. we cut, which
no, I'm not mocking you. Meeting, it's true.
I do enjoy everything that happened in the blah, blah, blah. I'm a Kyle Rayner fan. So anyways, we cut over to a studio over in LA where, some uppity big shot is firing all of the artists because he's excited about AI. So, it doesn't really matter. We don't have to pay health insurance and so on and so forth for all these, and salaries for all these people if we've got this thing. So he fires the entire artistic department. He sees a bug and he smacks it, but turns out it's one of the escaped science cell prisoners that infects him. We cut back over to Kyle and Odyssey. They have apparently rented a place above a pet store, and this is when Wally shows up to criticize the entire living situation. Kyle asks why he's here. It's revealed Linda told him to check in on him. They go have burgers, Wally's treat, because, you know, it's not like Kyle or any of the Green Lanterns, for that matter. Earth Green Lanterns are very liquid right now in terms of finances. And they're basically eating across the street from the studio lot. So Wally pushes him to say, well, you know, hey, why don't you get a job there? Spielberg got started sneaking onto the lot. So he keeps pushing him and they sneak onto the lot. And then he's like, well, it doesn't even matter. I don't have my portfolio. But he's talking to the fastest man alive, literally. And he runs over and grabs his portfolio and is like, all right, well, now what you got? What's your excuse? So they go off while Kyle does his thing. Kyle runs into one of the individuals who was just fired from the artistic team, and he goes in to talk to the lead, but he figures out that he is clearly possessed. So Kyle comes crashing into the area where Wally and Odyssey are, busting through the wall, and they have to suit up and figure out what's going on here. Nothing is really working. Kyle figures out that he is tapped into the AI. They all figure it out because the constructs that this creature is making, these are not emotional constructs. They're made out of, I don't know, something else. And they recognize that everything he's been making is from movies and so on and stuff that already exist. So he realized with the AI servers strapped to this guy's back and everything that he's pulling from, that he's only reliant on this information and this information alone. So Kyle starts talking about the importance of creativity and so on and so forth. This is obviously a meta commentary on everything that's going on in this industry right now with regards to AI. AI, as we know, is everywhere, but in the comics industry, it has its own challenges. So they're talking a bit about that while Kyle gets the upper hand to destroy the servers on this guy's back, and then uses a vacuum to suck the alien out of the studio exec, and they go off, and Odyssey and Kyle are like, hey, this place is actually pretty great. Meanwhile, out in space, we see Hal with Jan of the Wonder Twins. And they are being approached by manhunters who say no man escapes the manhunters in the same indigo-colored bubble that we saw the manhunters speaking in, who are clearly influenced by the Compassion entity on Biot in the Green Lantern Corps issue. They decide to get out of there. Basically, Jan is going to transform into a big-ass bear, and Hal's going to ride her through the crowd of manhunters to the ship in the hangar. Other side, they're in a sector house, by the way. There's more to talk about here, but for the sake of time, we'll circle back to it later in the discussion. Jan sees the ship, it's very alien looking, and asks, do you know how to fly it? To which Hal responds, kid, I know how to fly anything. And the two of them fly off in this ship out of this sector house. And it says, where is Hal going? Why don't they make more of these ships? And Kyle struggles to find a job, all next issue in Green Lantern.
All right, so we have a quick little interlude here where, and the art takes a dramatic, and it's funny, the art kind of like starts spiking once we get past the initial Kyle story, because now we have Dan Jurgens doing the art. It's like I'm looking like, this looks awfully good. Why does it look so familiar? It's like, oh yeah, it's Dan Jurgens, that's why. So we have Krona, a pseudo-Krona, floating in space, flying in space, and this is where it gets a little hodgepodgey, because he's still... At least they address it. It's kind of like lampshading again. They kind of acknowledge that Krona is not 100% Krona, but yet they also have to acknowledge that Krona seems to be pretty tunnel vision. That he knows what he's looking for, and he's got to get there. But supposedly, for some reason, he has no real understanding of why. There's no clear understanding of why Krona Prime wanted to use Hal Jordan as the vessel for, you know, the physical body for his scheme and his revenge on the core and the Guardians and all the stuff. So this leads into him tapping into the records, and he gets the Journal of Ganthet of all, you know. So we get a rehashing of Hal's origin, seeing Hal being fearless at a young age after his father died, and so that means standing up for what he thinks is right, even if he's fighting a bunch of kids who are 1,000 times the size and all this stuff. And his career in the Air Force and him having to choose between staying in the Air Force and being there for his mom. And, of course, that goes south, like most of the things in Hal's life go south. And his career for, you know, his career as Ferris and Abin Sur. And essentially, all this is just to get us to a little end where it says Hal Jordan is powerful not because of his ring, but because of who he is. And who he is fearless. So we see a whole bunch of different images of Hal, which, of course, we probably both appreciate because we kind of get the hard traveling heroes image. But, of course, we also get an Emerald Twilight image. We get a Zero Hour image. And we also have a Spectre mm-hmm. Hal Jordan image. So I think that's pretty cool.
Diana looks good there.
Yeah, actually, she does. And it's called Brighter Day, the origin of Hal Jordan.
Yeah. We also get a story by our friends. Yes, friends of the show, Ron Mars and Daryl Banks. We are talking, it is Kyle. He is doing a bit of self-reflection. I really want to say more and almost read a lot of this out loud, but for time's sake, we can't. It's really good. Then I'll just insert a bit of commentary here. It's just really good to read Kyle's inner thoughts in Ron Mars's voice again. So that is there. But in terms of the story itself, Kyle is painting on Oa, and he's just off in a secluded space. And then there is a ship that is crashing towards the planet with these two rookie Green Lanterns trying to ease its descent onto the planet's surface. Kyle runs in to save their ass and help this ship to the ground. They recognize him and who he is and say, you know, you're him. And he's like, him? Who? The Torchbearer. Everybody knows you. You're the one who preserved the legacy so the Corps could live again. Followed in the footsteps of the greatest Green Lanterns. You were a beacon in the darkness so everyone else could come after you, including us. So, fanboy much? he says, well, thanks, I guess. And he starts walking through the city and trying to get back to his painting. And, you know, he's like, I'm just doing what I could do. But how many people could do that? They ask. What's the secret? And there's not a secret. Despite everything I've been through, I'm still figuring things out myself. What I can tell you, you need to decide is who you are without the ring. And then be that same person with the ring. And he says, I'd like to finish my painting, and excuses himself, and they go off. This is what I've learned. Even when you're surrounded by darkness, you can be the light, always be the light. And we see the painting that he has made is this dark forest looking up at a floating, I want to see Japanese style lantern, just kind of floating in the middle of the darkness. And it says, always be the light. The end.
Yes. Very good. Very good. For sure. It ended on a really high note. Like I said, I kind of wish most of the Kyle stuff was handled by Ron and at least by Daryl. Even if Jeremy was going to write all the stuff in the beginning, I still don't understand why for this issue, why they couldn't have just had friggin' Daryl do the art. But I don't...
Are you referring this specifically to the Kyle flashback? Because I think his Zermanico parts are pretty great, as they have been consistently, artistically.
Do they distinguish which parts? Because he doesn't do all of that, right? He doesn't do everything.
Zermanico does all the stuff with Kyle, Odyssey, and Wally.
All right.
It's just the Kyle origin. That is the other that is.
Oh, you're right. You're right. So, yeah, I'm OK with the Germanico stuff. The Marion stuff is not nearly as effective, I don't think.
Reminds me a bit of Tyler Kirkham.
Yes. And it's got the manga thing, too, working.
I don't think I personally have a problem with it. I don't think it works well in juxtaposition to Zermanico's art, is what I think.
Objectively, I think that's the issue, or arguably with the whole issue, is that you have dramatically different styles of art, and you go from you go from that the stuff in the beginning to Dan Jurgens, which is kind of going to be tough to top anyway. Then you have Daryl at the end. So, I mean, it gets better. I mean, it's certainly better than beginning with Jurgens and Daryl and then ending, let's say, with Marion. But I think that's always the danger when you have multiple, when you do, I mean, there are multiple stories. You know, you can make a case that shoehorning in quotes, Kyle's origin is not really another story. They delve a little, you know, they kind of do delve deeper or do some retcon, Jeffcon borderline things just as far as to give us more meat on the bone. But it's not really a separate story. It's really, it's a sub story. I guess that's the best way to describe it. But that's the problem when you have multiple stories in the same issue like this, is that you have to worry about it. It's a little easier because other than the end, Jeremy writes everything. So at least you're getting some kind of consistent narrative tone. I think that's better. But I mean, I think overall I don't have major issues with the art. It's just that, again, once you get to the Jurgens and Daryl stuff at the end, then it kind of makes the other stuff look a little, to me, it makes it look a little weaker by comparison, especially because Jurgens does Hal so well and obviously Daryl does Kyle so well that it's kind of like it's kind of hard to compete on that level.
Yeah, agreed. Jumping around a little bit, I think I'll start with the Kyle main story stuff here. Not as bad as we were expecting, it feels like.
Nope.
I like the idea that he is here for a Green Lantern reason. We're not just, you know, going to be focusing on the whole Kyle getting a job thing and the whole Odyssey thing. Like, yes, it'll still be there, but I'm not fully on board, but I'm a little more comforted than I was before. So maybe it'll flesh out. We'll see. The AI stuff is, I mean, like, we know we have seven villains to get through. Seven criminals to capture, or whatever we want to call it. So, you know,
I guess that means Kyle probably has seven issues.
but then if it's seven criminals, seven issues, you risk doing the whole, you know, what Smallville did, the whole Freak of the Week thing. You know, it became kind of a trope to okay, who's our new meteor powered freak? So this is the same thing every issue. If we only are going to have Kyle be the stewardess book for, like you said, about seven issues to match the seven people, then it's going to feel a little repetitive to be introduced and then figure out the problem in the same issue for seven issues back to back. So I don't know that that's going to be the case. I will say look, I get the point they're making about AI, and it's a good point just overall, because the discussion around AI is something we need to have anyways in almost every facet that AI touches, which is quite a lot. But the comic book industry is definitely one because of, you know, people using AI to full on replace artists and creators and so on and so forth. And just, you know, it's not truly unique. All it can do, at least currently, is generate imagery based on mushing and mashing various other references together into what it thinks is one cohesive image. So it's not really creating anything. It's just sort of putting things in a blender and mixing for a little bit. It's an interesting meta way to deal with that, especially with Kyle being an artist. So at least it's done in such a way and in such a context that Kyle gets to be the one of all people to say something on page about it. But I also think the studio executive thing, the firing the entire artistic department thing, it felt a little too nail on the head.
Yeah, I think so too. It was a little, especially because he's just like, he was firing everybody. Then the guy who was trying to make the case was like, well, you can't fire everybody. Then he gets fired too. And choosing to make the villain of the villain of the month be another borderline parasite that takes over someone as a host. I swear to God, I thought it was Timu Parallax at first, until it became crystal clear that he was one of the ones, because it was yellow and he was kind of almost in the Parallax font too, the entity font. So it's like, oh my God, this is where Timu Parallax went, and boom, and he took him over. So that I kind of seemed like an it kind of seemed like a little bit of an odd choice too. But the AI thing. I agree with your basic view on that.
Yeah. It was nice to have Wally here. I liked that. It looks like he might be sticking around for an issue or two, given solicits or covers images that we've seen. And if that's the case, based on how he's written here, I like that because I like that he's not allowed. Like, it's one thing for Odyssey to she doesn't necessarily look up to Kyle, but she's new to Earth. She's new to this whole situation. He's kind of I don't know if he's her friend or if he's just her. I don't know. The person who's supposed to keep an eye on her, you know, I don't know. But it's nice to have somebody who knows Kyle so well that they're not going to let him get any bullshit past him and just be like, no, dude. OK, what's your next excuse? Here's your portfolio. I ran and got it for you. What's next? So I like that. I like that Wally is here to push Kyle and not let him just sort of coast because you do kind of get that idea a little bit because they present it in his origin. The idea of, you know, him getting sucked into a thing and just becoming hyper-focused and abandoning all else. But we also see the look on his face when Jessica is checking in on him. And he's like, kind of almost like your mom is like, did you get your homework done? And he's like, yeah, I'll get to it. Like he doesn't say that outright, but it really feels like he's avoiding her and he doesn't really want to do this. So I like the idea that, we're going to let Kyle have that trait because we have seen Kyle have that trait in the past and it looks like it's resurfacing, but Wally's not going to let it happen. I like that.
No, I agree. I think it was showing some understanding of Kyle qualities and characteristics. So I think that was, and it's also somewhat weird. It's like, if he knows if he's basically being quote unquote allowed on Earth for a certain period of time, because he really has this mission to catch these seven villains. It's like, how much of a new life can he really plan on starting? Because you know you have a really short shelf life here.
Yeah.
This is like Kyle being Hal, in the sense that it's like, okay, he's back, but he's only going to be back for a really, really limited engagement because the Corps is going to need him somewhere else, even if he wants to stay.
Yeah. No, I agree. The other thing I thought was very confusing is the covers and everything and the solicits, the fact that we heard about this issue so far in advance and got some cover images and stuff like that so far in advance. For all of that pomp and circumstance, they really didn't make any big deal about the new costume.
Yeah, and then it just kind of like happens. So we don't even get a reason why or even a discussion of, and maybe we will. Maybe there'll be some kind of Odyssey conversation. But yeah, I think I thought it was kind of like just dropped out there, and I had to even go look at this. That's one of the areas where I don't think the art necessarily worked the best. Cause I'm looking at this and I was like, that is the new costume, right? Cause you kind of can tell by the shoulder pads that it's a new costume and things like that, but it's not as crystal clear all along that. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, like, you would think we'd get the splash page of it going over him and Wally being like, cool, new suit. You know, that's what you come to expect. But this big spider construct thing, you know, when he kicks Kyle through the wall and he joins up with Odyssey and Wally, that gets a splash and then they all suit up. But it's one of four panels on the page. And he's behind Odyssey. So it's just, that's our first look of it in story. That just feels weird. Almost like so weird it's maybe intentional. And I guess we'll figure out why later. Who knows?
Yeah. And obviously Odyssey is meant to have a relationship with Wally's son.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which again, if you read The Flash, I'm sure that would mean something to you. But since we're Green Lantern people and the majority probably did not read much of that of The Flash run. That's another thing that it's, you know, borderline being self-serving, a character that Jeremy created in another book and a relationship that has meaning in another book that really doesn't mean anything to us. And it's kind of hard that it's ever going to, because she's not a Green Lantern character. And I don't think I doubt she's going to be sticking around indefinitely, though. If she does, again, that'll be self-serving, too.
Yeah, for you guys playing along at home, Wally says, I know a few time travelers myself. In fact, my son Jai falls madly in love with one later. It's super confusing. And then in the background, you see Odyssey go, Jai, why does that name sound familiar? Or why does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
So I guess we'll find out later. The Kyle retelling of the origin. Was he at the club because of Alex originally?
I know. I mean, as far as we know, that's a retcon as far as we know, because Alex
not a big one, but
it's like a Jeffcon more than a retcon. Because remember the early part is he either went out to get some air because he was drunk, and then there was another retcon where he kind of went out with his friend of his who was drunk and was throwing up, and that's how right before he met Ganthet. So they've been kind of playing fast and loose with all of this, just like even whenever the hell it was, and like in the New 52 when they tried a retcon making it sound like that Kyle was actually chosen on purpose, not because it was random.
Guardians.
Yeah, the new beginning of the New Guardians. When they did that and like making it sound like he was actually chosen for his worthiness as opposed to doing a pretty faithful revisiting of Ganthet saying, yeah, you'll have to do. I appreciated that they at least they seemingly did their homework enough to try to give that the actual encounter when Kyle got to ring it as verbatim as they felt they could.
Yeah. As for the Hal stuff, I don't have much to say about the Hal and Jan stuff. I think it's going to be fun just to see more DCU stuff in there. I like the keeping in continuity between this and Green Lantern Corps with the color of the word bubbles for No Man Escapes the Manhunters. Clearly, they're infected by the same thing, or this is happening relatively simultaneously, given the fact that maybe, we have no idea, the Manhunters being powered by Indigo could be over by the end of the next core issue, depending on if they get Proselyte back or not. So this is all just a little bit of a time thing. It doesn't really give us much here. You get a Hal Jordan moment in terms of like, kid, I know how to fly anything. So that's cool. As far as the Hal's retelling of his origin, I'm okay with it. But again, we still got nothing about Krona. I mean, I get that we see this page of him, and I get that he's curious of why Krona Prime, as you put it, or as they put it, chose Hal Jordan, but it still gives us nothing as to what he's up to.
No, I agree. I mean, I guess we have to be happy that they didn't try to shoehorn in a resolution to the Krona thing in one issue. That would have sucked more. So thank God that they kind of did what they did as far as I would almost rather it not be barely addressed as opposed to trying to resolve the whole issue. And, you know, have like, which I kind of somehow in my mind, I kind of still figured this was going to be like an 80% Hal book. And then the last part would be Kyle getting back to Earth or whatever, or vice versa. Or we see Kyle and then we figure out and why Hal is kind of literally lost in space. I guess the only thing we get out of Hal is more confirmation of Barry's pulling it out of his you know what, the tachyon thing comes from Hal and sending himself a message, future Hal sending current Hal a message, because we get the fact that Jaina was contacted by Hal telling her to be here at this particular time and hit the button at the particular time, and Hal's like, what, huh, what? So this is obviously not this Hal. This is Hal somewhere down the road, or a different Hal telling Jaina that. So that just kind of that, I guess, is a little reinforcement if you happen to remember that issue with Barry and Hal, that kind of just reinforces that shot in the dark that, yeah, this is kind of what I think.
Yeah. As for the Daryl Ron stuff, I liked it. The art is great. I love that he's playing around with these alien designs and the fact that one of them looks like it's like a zebra fish, right? It's a zebra fish head on a bipedal body. So that's interesting design, weird design, but they're aliens, so you get to do whatever the hell you want. And then obviously Daryl's having fun because look at all these freaking constructs made by both these aliens and by Kyle. Also, speaking of constructs, it's not one that Kyle makes, but one of these lanterns puts up iterations of Kyle's costume from the past, including White Lantern, his Ion costume from that Ion series when he had like stars in it, and then who did the one where he's squatting? That was
In the Winnick run, right?
Jim Lee.
Jim Lee
designed Kyle Rayner costume. And then, of course, this is interesting to me because if I'm not wrong, this might be the first time Daryl is ever drawing the original Ion costume in continuity, because he wasn't the artist on The Power of Ion.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I mean, it might arguably be a case that this is the first time he's drawing a lot of these costumes.
It's true.
I also wonder if the birdhead alien, if that's somehow tied to the Buck Rogers series, because it kind of looks like Hawk, that character that was introduced later on, like in the second season when they retooled the Gil Gerard Buck Rogers TV show, that the Hawk character had kind of had a feathered head like that. So
it's funny you say that, because Voodoo just has a sale going on for a lot of WB stuff. This is related, I promise. So I picked up the entirety of Duck Dodgers, including the Green Lantern.
so you mean that show that they had,
the entirety of the Duck Dodgers 4 seasons cartoons.
That was fun. That was, but yeah, it makes me wonder because of the age Daryl is, that it makes me wonder that it would not be un. It would not. I should just ask him that. It would not be.
I DM'd him actually already, asking him if this is the first time he's drawn that Ion costume. He hasn't responded yet.
I messaged him too. Not about a question or anything. But it just makes me wonder, because of the fact that there's a little bit of similarity with like the feathered top of her head. But I like both these. I like both of these lanterns. Those are pretty cool. It'd be nice if we would see them again. No, I really like this story. Again, it's nice seeing. To me, this just seems like Kyle.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like home. So yeah, and plus you see the classic costume, which is obviously something we're not going to be seeing short term again. But Kyle changes his costumes a lot. So, but I like that story. I think it was. I do like the revisiting of the Torchbearer stuff. I mean, I think once in a while that's good. So this issue is very much a primer. It's very much a jumping on point. I don't necessarily know if I agree with what some people have said, that this just seems like, this seems like a typical anniversary issue. Obviously there's aspects of it, but I don't know. I mean, more of a typical anniversary issue, especially a 600th issue, probably would have been more of an anthology than we got, and not having the majority of a significant portion. If you want to consider the origin of Kyle a separate story, when it really isn't, it's kind of like in the middle of one big Kyle story.
Mm-hmm.
That at least we have two stories, all the Hal stuff, including the Krona sub-story, and Kyle stuff, including the Kyle origin sub-story. All that actually is relating to stuff that's going on now in continuity, and only the Daryl and the Daryl Ron story at the end is unrelated, though they purposely kind of leave it vague to when exactly this falls into the time frame.
Yeah, this just feels like the next issue with two reasons to shoehorn in
returns
of origins.
Yeah, and it's definitely trying to be a primer to try to get people who are as a jumping on issue, which again, I don't know, because of the way the issue is laid out, if this really is a natural jumping on issue, but I guess they're counting on it being labeled issue 600. So some people will buy it who normally don't read Green Lantern. So they're hoping that they lay enough breadcrumbs to get people to stick around for the next issue or so. But it just seemed heavy on this is who Kyle is and why he's important. And this is who Hal Jordan is. And this is why he's important. So, which I get. But again, if you wanted to look at a 600th issue of Green Lantern, as much as I'm a Hal guy and I like Kyle, you would think they have some of the other lanterns, you know, would have been represented here too. But that's why I think it's a tad different, as opposed to like the Green Lantern 80th anniversary special when we did that and things.
Yeah. The last thing I wanted to talk about was just the covers for this issue, because it's, you know, issue 600. So we have a little bit more than normal. What covers did you, or will you be getting?
I'll be curious to see actually which ones were pulled for me, because I haven't got my books in friggin' forever. There's only one that's really Hal, right?
Well, two.
I mean, only Hal.
Two.
How come I'm not seeing all these?
So there's the main cover, and then there's the one with the white background with Hal shooting up behind in front of a city.
Yeah, that's the only one. And what was the other? Oh, you're right. The main cover. You're right. I completely zoned out about the main cover. I don't. That's too damn busy for me.
Yeah.
So given the choice, I would probably take the Hal flying above everything or the Green Lantern symbol. I don't mind the most of the Kyle ones are not bad. I don't like the one when Kyle's ring is with the multicolored background when his ring hand is on the left hand side and his fist is raised up. I don't like that one.
David Nakayama.
Yeah. I know it's the new costume, so maybe that's part of it. But even though it looks like he's wearing the new costume in all these covers, the Zomanico cover looks kind of weird. I mean, I guess it's more appropriate because he's the one who's drawing him in this issue. And yeah, I could do. And the one where he's got the beard on, that's weird too.
It's glow in the dark too.
That's a plus. But the I think I would either get the Green Lantern Corps symbol, the Green Lantern symbol, or the Hal flying above the city, even though it has your dreaded white space.
Yeah, but so does Zermanico's, because I think Zermanico definitely could have done a background here.
It's not white.
Yeah, I get what they're going for, but just to focus on the new costume. But, I don't. Plus, Kyle looks derpy as hell for some reason in that particular image. So I avoided basically all of these except for the main cover, which I placed an order online this morning for the stuff that I need, because there's also a couple of variants, and I posted about these over on Twitter, a couple of recent Star Sapphire related variants on the Justice League Unlimited series, including today's issue. It's like an image of Hal and Carol sitting together. It's a view of a couple from behind them, like when they're sitting on a bench and leaning into each other all cutesy or whatever. It's that same thing with Hal and Carol, but they're on a piece of flotsam looking down on the earth, like just some sort of debris for today's issue of Justice League Unlimited. And then there was another one, and a Batwoman thing that I was really into. So I ordered a few things today, including the main cover of this, as well as the Scott Koblish Legacy variant, because that's a double page spread of just God hundreds of lanterns, to the point where I actually, when this is solicited, I reached out to Scott Koblish to talk a bit about this cover and get some information out of him. And he gave us basically the key, the answer key to all of this cover to talk about. There is exactly 136 individual lanterns on here. Anyone from frickin' Charlie Vickers to Sodom Yat to frickin' Iolande or Gorin Sun, the Puffball Collective, Stell's in here, Alan's in here, obviously, Narf, Amanita, I mean, Floto Span. There's so many lanterns that we have, as lantern fans, long ago forgotten, or, you know, we just, I'm not even looking at the list anymore, looking at the image. Raimi Hall from The Corpse, like as in terms of like the Black Ops unit, that butterfly lantern that we met way back when, she's in there. This is a badass variant. Whether you like Scott's like art style or not, this is a hefty task, and a lot of research went into this cover, and I had to have it.
No, it's, I can understand that. It is, and I do remember the key. I do remember that email. It's not an easy. It's not an easy thing to do to try to, when you want people to actually be able to recognize what the characters. I mean, it's easy to just do some in the background. And it's like, well, if you look really, really close enough and say, hey, look, it's Raker Karagat. If you look really closely, you can tell by his headgear. It's like, no, you want to make this where you have a pretty good shot to be able to distinguish who's who. I agree. I think it takes a lot of work.
For sure. And shout out to Scott, by the way, because I reached out to him back in early January. We are recording this towards the end of March, guys. And Scott came through with the answer key, a black and white version of this. And then in addition to the answer key, a numbered image so that we could compare the key to the image. And that was a full two, nearly 3 months ago in advance of this issue. So shout out, Scott. It obviously, it doesn't mean anything in turn. It wouldn't spoil the issue because there's nothing on here that it's just like a good, it's almost like a Where's Waldo for Lantern fans. So obviously he didn't do anything worth getting in trouble over, but this is that's still awesome for him to go that far and share that with us. So shout out, Scott.
Indeed.
All right. What's next?
Well, I suppose we want to talk a little bit about Project Hail Mary. Now that we've both seen the movie.
Yeah, you go first, man, because I've talked ad nauseum about this film a couple of different times, so.
And I just got the book, which I will at some point in the near future read. I want to make sure I can actually sit there and try to finish it in a timely fashion, as opposed to being one of the thousands of books that I start reading and slowly work my way through. Slowly I turn, step by step. I really enjoyed it. I think by far it's the best thing that's I've seen this year, you know, and that may be a pretty low bar. I mean, considering, but I think that's going to hold up as we move on throughout the year. I would be stunned if this movie isn't at least in the top three or no worse than top five with all the things that I see. It was, you know, it plays at your heartstrings. It does what it's supposed to do. Is the narrative structure and telling the story out of order, does that always work? I don't know if it always works. I think it's effective enough. I think that it's funny. The odd couple relationship between him and Rocky is really funny. Just like the Rocky analogy, not just because that's what he looks like, but once it gets more tied into the Rocky Balboa aspect of it, it's always funny too. That he's Rocky on multiple levels as far in the relationship. When he's explaining the Rocky movies to him, is just funny. And in the seventh one, he trains his son. That was fun. And you know, naming the planet Adrian, things like that. That I really enjoyed it. I did not, like you talked about, we didn't know entirely what liberties they were going to take with the book as the movie played out. So based on what you were saying about the book, when it looked like, well, maybe they really are going to kill him off. That was really upsetting to me that they thought, well, maybe that was something that didn't happen in the book, but it's going to happen in the movie because they want to have him go back home. Mm-hmm. But I thought that whole thing was emotional. The whole thing about Rocky being upset what was happening with Grace, and then Grace being ridiculously upset that he thought Rocky was dead and doing everything he could to try to bring him back. I thought it was good. I also thought, like you described, that I guess your whatever concerns, I mean, about the ending of the movie having it be too much like The Martian, I think they kind of did a good job with that. One thing I did as a question for someone who didn't read the book. Was that a change? Was that a change in the story that they at least give the hope, or the hope is maybe the wrong word, except that if it is a change, it's clearly for the audience, not necessarily the character. The idea that Grace can go home. Was that a change?
So no, that is in the book. Rocky does come to him and say, hey, you know, the scientists for my planet is, you know, that we figured out. We can fuel you up and get you back home. And he is kind of hesitant. He's like, he's almost, but also like, they don't go into this. Like, the food on Rocky's world is inedible for a human. It is too, as you would imagine, too high in heavy metals and so on and so forth for a human to be able to safely consume anything. But they figure out he eats what he calls me burgers, which is they clone his anatomy and for him to have meat to eat.
Ew, that's gross. Yeah,
I know. Totally, but I mean, you got to do what you got to. But he's so in love with teaching. Plus the gravity's a bit weird, so he's walking with a cane. He's older. In the movie, he's not older. He seems like it's months, maybe a year at max, whatever. Actually, I guess if the Beatles are arriving back on Earth. To Strat in them so they can figure out everything that they said that journey takes 4 years. And
yeah, I think it's about 4 years. Yeah.
So but he's definitely older than 4 years in the book when we see him at the end of the movie. We actually see we see nothing about Strat or any of the stuff happening on Earth after the Beatles or anything. We just know that he sends the stuff to Earth in the Beatles. We never cut back to Strat ever again in the book. And the only thing we know about it having worked is that their scientists have detected that our son has recovered. So we know it worked. That's all we really get.
Yeah, that was one of the things I thought might have, based on what you were describing, may have changed just because they figured it would, even if Grace didn't really care about whether he was going home, that the audience might kind of look at it and go, well, you know, he's all alone and blah 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 blah, and after all, and that, so at least raising the specter that if he chose to go home, he could, or he's somewhere down the road if he chooses to go home, but. Realistically, he doesn't really have anything there. I mean, other than teaching, but the point is he has no real close attachments to anybody. So yeah. does it really matter if he still has a purpose where he is? Does it really matter that he goes home?
Yeah. There's a bunch of stuff left out of this. I don't think that takes away from the movie, because I think it's a pretty fantastic film. And a great adaptation. I saw it in IMAX, which was not the wrong move at all. It looked great, especially those scenes above Adrian. And, you know, when everything goes infrared there for a bit and he's floating in those pink sparkles or whatever. You've seen this movie.
Yep.
Moment in the trailers. Just really looks, all the space stuff, it looks just fantastic in IMAX. The stuff that they left out are things like, so... In order to help give the Earth a fighting chance, you know how like in The Martian, you know, they figure out ways to buy him time to get food supplies or something to him or get his crops to last a little bit longer. We have to buy a little bit more time for Earth for this Project Hail Mary plan to work. But instead of doing something logical like sending a food drop was to Watney on Mars, they decide to release enough, I think, methane to produce enough of a global warming effect to insulate the Earth a bit to give us more time. And they accomplish this by nuking Antarctica. That is how desperate that they little, like, obviously we understand the planet is at risk, the cold stuff. Like, I think they get that through to you in this film. But they don't really push how dire things are enough, I feel like, because they end up nuking Antarctica. Also, in order to produce enough energy to reproduce enough astrophage to get the fuel they need, they cover the Sahara Desert with solar panels and build factories, essentially, to power said, to use said power to run the system that creates more astrophage. And obviously covering an entire section of the planet is also its own, you know, huge undertaking. There's a scene in the book where Strat has to attend a hearing, a copyright hearing, because at the end of the movie, that laptop that Grace gives Rocky, that's a thing because they are sent into space with essentially a digital archive of everything humanity has ever done. Every book, every movie, every piece of music, basically nothing is off the table, because we need to give our people on the Project Hail Mary anything they could possibly require from Earth, because they can't communicate with us if they run into an issue. They need absolutely everything humanity has ever done on this ship with them. And so they get caught in this copyright argument. And this Strat has a moment in that, in the thing she says there, and I won't go back to it or bother quoting it or anything, but she has this moment where it's just like, the whole world's at stake. Come at me if you must, but she is given unparalleled access. They show that a little bit in this, but you just have to really, you have to think about it a bit more to really understand how much power they have given Strat in this book, or in this story, because he discovers how to reproduce astrophage, and then in an instant he is on a jet, and that aircraft carrier that he lands on in the book, that is a Chinese aircraft carrier. So he like lands in Russia, gets transferred to China. That like they really push how unparalleled access she talks about, and they very clearly, at least I hope there's got to be like a longer cut of this movie, because when we actually see Strat at the end of this movie, which like I said, we didn't see her at the end of the book, she has a tattoo on her neck, which it looks like a prison tat. The reason for that, Strat talks about everything she has to do to make this project work, and everybody, like, she fully expects to go to prison for everything she's doing, because somebody, the Earth is, we're going to need a fall guy of some kind, we're going to need a bad guy, she needs to be held accountable for all of the liberties she's taken and all of the people she has pissed off along the way. So she is much more, I don't want to say ruthless, but they make her so, I guess, relatable a little bit, or at least sympathetic, especially with the karaoke scene, which is not in the book, that I for a moment, didn't it also feel like they were maybe trying to do something romantically with the two?
Yeah, I would say so.
No, Strat is I don't give a shit what has to be done to make this work. My goal is to make this project happen because it's the only chance we have. So I'll be damned what I have to do to get us there. And also, when Grace comes in to talk to her about rejecting going on the mission, because this is the thing, I knew I was spoiling the absolute shit out of this story all the way up to it, but I did intentionally leave out that the fact that, okay, yes, he's forgotten his memory, yes, he meets an alien, so on, and yes, even how the book ends, I did not say that he is there against his will. So that's actually the big reveal of the book, at least, is that his memories finally get to the point where he realizes, oh, everything I've been doing, I said I was incapable of, and I am here against my will. But Strat calls him a coward to his face, and they put him in the coma in advance so that, and they explain it away to his two other teammates or mission mates or whatever who died and obviously died. They just explain it away to them that he was so nervous he wanted to be put out for the launch. So that's how they didn't know that he was there against his will. There's so many things like that. Also, I think they really dumbed down a lot of the science or didn't focus it on it too much. I get it's a long story. I get they already focused on a lot of science. But there's so much more that they left out. Like, for instance, when we see him in the opening scene fall out of his coma, his bed and everything, and the machine's trying to drag him back, he almost immediately climbs up that ladder to that second space inside of the ship. In the book, he doesn't get up that ladder until like four or five chapters in. There's no window in that same area. So even though he is not aware of who he is, the movie doesn't really do a very good job of that. He has to figure out who he is, not just why he's there, but who he is, because the computer is asking a question, what is your name? And it will not unlock the next section of the ship until he can correctly answer it. But he figures out he's in space because he falls down in that area at one point and realizes he fell wrong, gravity-wise. And he does math to figure out, okay, I am in space or something. I got to figure out where I am. And then he realizes by doing even more math that the way in which he's falling or whatever, like he figures out mathematically, gravity wise, so on and so forth, that he's not even close to his planet, to his sun or anything through math before even seeing outside into space. So I get that all of that could be very boring on film or stuff, but that's just an example of the amount of math that's in this story. Also, they don't really do a good job of explaining this. Obviously Rocky's crewmates died because because of their lack of vision and the way in which they see the world, they aren't aware of solar radiation and the effects of time dilation. Rocky, by the way, because of the effects of time dilation, was alone orbiting Tau Ceti for 45 years before he met Grace.
That's a big difference.
His people were long dead. And he had no idea why. And he was the engineer. He wasn't the scientist of his crew. He was alone orbiting Tau Ceti with no idea of how to fix the problem he was sent there for, because the people who were there who were supposed to fix the problem are dead. And he's alone. And by the way, the reason his species watches each other sleep is because when an Iridian sleeps, it's not like us where we're like, you know, if a loud noise happens or whatever, we're somewhat aware of our surroundings and can jolt awake. They are out. Complete, almost near, you could assume they were dead. They are out when they're asleep. So they have evolved to protect themselves from predators and so on and so forth. They watch each other sleep. And then it's almost like a timer, you know, like the way in which their system works. They sleep for a set amount of time, and then their body kind of comes back online. So not only was he alone for 45 years, he was alone. He had to sleep alone, not knowing if every sleep he could die or something could go wrong.
Yeah, I mean, they give a little bit of that, but yes, it's probably not as impactful, or you don't get the full magnitude of it just based on how they touched upon it in the movie.
And there's a few characters that we don't get to meet, like the scientific crew behind the Project Hail Mary before it launches. There's some people we see, but not enough. Also, the really big one, the reason they have a hard time trying to find people for the mission is not necessarily the mission itself. There's an added complication of, because you have to put people into a coma to get to Tau Ceti, and you have to do it for such an extended amount of time, it's actually, and I think this is another piece of fiction that Andy Weir made up, as far as I'm aware. I'm 98% sure this is the case. But he introduces the concept that there are people, of humanity who have like a coma resistance. Like they're not impacted the same way by an extended coma as most of the populace would be. Strat secretly has Rylan tested and knows well in advance of even the other team dying in that accident that he has the coma resistance gene.
Yeah, that would be valuable research. You think that would make sense, considering?
Yep. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that. But I think, none of that. Some of that impacts the story or impacts the intensity or the urgency of everything that's going on. But I don't think any of it is necessarily absolutely critical. You may feel differently now that you read the book, so definitely let me know what you think when you actually read the book. But I thought they did a masterful job of pulling it off. I did feel like, even though this is exactly what happens in the book, I did feel like the point where him and Rocky split up, and then he figures out that the Talmeba have evolved not only to have the nitrogen resistance, but also, and they say this in the line in the book is like, evolution is messy. Like, it's just because you take the time to intentionally force evolution and breed out certain traits doesn't necessarily mean that other things can't enter the equation that you weren't accounting for just because you were hyper-focused on breeding out the one specific thing. So the one specific thing he didn't account for was the fact that it would become able to pass through the Xenonite. So the fact that we're saying goodbye to Rocky, then there's a problem, we're going back to Rocky, it almost felt like, oh, the movie's ending. Oh, wait, the movie's not over. Which felt was not the feeling that I got when I was reading the book. It all just felt like one story, but it felt like, because the movie, I don't want to say it was so long, like I was, you know, ready to get out of there. I was in my seat. I was happy to see what was going on. It felt like maybe the average moviegoer would be like, oh, we're wrapping up here. Okay, cool. Oh, wait, what's this next piece? I thought we were ending the whole thing, but there's still more to be told. I don't know if people would feel jolted by that, but that's the only hiccup in tone that I felt as somebody who's familiar with the story.
I think the movie, which is tough because you're taking the source material and you're trying to do justice. That's where it gets tricky. But just looking at it as a movie, especially since I haven't read the book yet, I would say that it's probably they could have probably shaved like at least another 10 minutes or so off, maybe 10, 15 minutes, made it a little tighter. I was never bored in it, and I don't think many people ever said they were bored, but I think you there's a few moments when I think you do kind of feel that it's long. But and I think that might be a byproduct of the narrative structure by going back and forth between flashbacks and seeing stuff on Earth and different parts of just being not told in chronological order. I think that maybe also makes it feel on some levels it maybe affects how you judge the length of the movie. But overall, I really enjoyed it. It certainly did not disappoint.
Mm-hmm. Soundtrack was really good, I thought. For those of you who don't know, Rocky is not CGI. That is a puppet. Obviously, there's CGI used to, you know, help enhance some things in the movie, but Rocky is primarily a puppet. Obviously, it needs to be cleaned up a little bit in post, but other than that, entirely a puppet. A lot of the things done on that set were... You'd be surprised. I can't tell you where all these places are, but I've been watching a lot of interviews and stuff with various people associated with this film. There are so many more practical effects in this film than you would think. It was really well done cinematically from what I can tell. Also, that thing I figured out about, I say I figured out like I discovered it myself, but I did notice it when I was watching the movie, but I didn't think anything of it. I saw an interview and I found somebody quoted it, a direct quote from some interview about the movie. So in the final little scene that we added back on Earth where she's getting the message that Great sent her, she has a little tattoo that has a V with a line through it, meaning V as in life, and then the line meaning without parole. So Andy thought that she had gone to prison without parole, but then had broken out of prison from her connections and then was sort of on the lam trying to still save the world.
Yep, that makes sense. That kind of matches too.
So that was how they alluded to, you know, Strat's whole like, oh, I fully intend to be put on trial and go to prison after this stuff, without actually showing that in the film in that conversation and everything. So I don't know. I really enjoyed it. Everybody seems to love Rocky. He's the new darling, as he should be. Amaze, amaze, amaze.
Yeah, I think it's excellent. Anyone who hasn't seen it, they should go see it. It's definitely worth seeing, no matter what kind of, even if you can't see it in a premium theater, premium screen, you should see it anyway. It hits all the beats that a movie should hit. So I think that probably be hard pressed to find too many movies this year that are going to do that.
For sure. I did not see Spider-Man Brand New Day on my trailer package either.
No, nothing. My trailer
package. Although I did see a trailer for that, was it Steven Spielberg movie that looks pretty good?
Disclosure Day thing. I'm not saying I'm not going to see it. I don't think, I don't know if I've seen the new trailer, but at least the initial trailer that didn't do anything for me. Yeah, the trailer package really sucked. I mean, I was really disappointed. I mean, we were in one of the two biggest theaters that my Regal has, and we did not have Dune, nor did we have Brand New Day. And it's like, I couldn't friggin' believe it. It's like,
we definitely had Dune.
Yeah, we had nothing. We had neither. I couldn't believe it. I was so disappointed. It's like, it doesn't make a damn lick of sense. I mean, I know, I understand they build these things based on the trailers that are recommended, but I don't understand why if there was going to be one trailer that was going to be common on every single one of those, it would probably be Spider-Man. Or at least it would be Dune. It'd be one of the two. And the fact that my print, quote unquote, had neither one of those I couldn't believe that had neither one of those trailers. I was so disappointed.
Did you have Masters of the Universe too?
Yeah, we had that. Okay. I had seen that before, but I'm trying to remember if I'd seen it in the theater, but I know I had seen it online. That it did have, but it did, but no. I'm trying to remember if that was the last trailer. I don't remember what the last trailer before the movie started was, but I thought it was a given, take it to the bank, that we were at least going to have Spider-Man and probably Spider-Man and Dune, and we had neither. It was, I couldn't, Thank God the movie was good, because if the movie had been so, that residual disappointment would have carried over. It's like, wow. It's like, I can't. It's like, he had one job.
For sure. Yeah. All right. Anything else?
In closing, for anyone who did not see Saw X, despite my praising of this movie almost friggin' 3 years ago now, Saw X is finally on Netflix. In fact, something I don't think I've ever been able to say on any streaming platform, that every single Saw movie, I believe, currently is on Netflix. The original 7, Jigsaw, Spiral, Saw X, all of them currently are on Netflix. So I thought that's kind of cool. Now, if only we could build a playlist, it'd be fantastic. But the reality is, yes, I would. And as last time I checked, Saw X was still hanging into the top 10 since it came on like a week or so ago. So that's kind of cool. That's pretty much it. It's just the fact that I almost wanted to mention that last week, but it was coming on, and now that it's on, and I've watched it a bunch of times, put it on to fall asleep to a bunch of times. But the fact that you can pick and choose which Saw movie. So if you haven't gotten into Saw yet and you're kind of curious, now is the time if you have Netflix, because you can literally watch them all.
Last thing I want to say, because I made several posts about it on social media today, we won't be doing this every episode from now till June. But a reminder, GL June is coming up. Flash and Green Lantern, The Brave and the Bold, the 6-issue Mark Waid series. Mark Waid, Tom Payer, and Barry Kitson doing the art, of course. We're covering that for GL June this year, all throughout the month of June. Lanterns Live, Mosaic Comics, Emerald Echo, Green Lanterns Podcast, Podcast of Oa, joining us for that. The reason I mention it, in addition to the fact that I announced it today on social media, is to give you guys plenty of time, if you do not own this story in any way, shape, or form, to find it in some way. If it's in your collection, just in long boxes, start looking for it so you can read along. I would send you to in-stock trades or Amazon, but I believe the story is out of print, so much so that I pulled it up on Amazon and it's saying a paperback is $41. So if you're looking for this, I think you might be better off just trying to get all the single issues on like eBay or something. I'm looking right now. All 6 issues, there's a listing for $10, there's a listing for $15, so on and so forth. So if you don't own them, you can find the single issues, or I'm not sure which digital services have them, like if the DC app or any of that stuff has it in there or not. I would imagine so, since Mark Waid is still employed by DC. They might have more of his work than the average person. But yeah. Flash, Green Lantern, The Brave and the Bold coming in June for GL June. So start looking for your issues or finding them if you don't already have them, so you're ready in a few months.
Yep, it'll be here before you know it.
All right. If people want to reach out to us, what do they do?
Lanterncast.com is a website. Lanterncast@gmail.com is the easiest way to contact us. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter, X, Facebook, use hashtag GLcast to track us down. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, wherever you listen to us on. Please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a text or a voicemail, 708 Lantern, and let us know what you think.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.